This is Laura Deirdre with the Becker Spine and Orthopedic Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Kern Singh, co-director of the Minimally Invasive Spine Institute at Midwest Orthopedics at Rush in Chicago. Dr. Singh, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Laura, thank you for having me on.
Before we dive into the questions, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background?
Sure. I'm a minimally invasive spine surgeon, 16 years at practice. As you mentioned previously, co-director at the Minimally Invasive Spine Institute here at Midwest Orthopedics at Rush. I'm a professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Rush University Medical Center. It's been 16 years since I began clinical practice. I was classically trained, open surgeon, orthopedic based. My residency was kind of more of a traditional residency, and then same with my fellowship. And then through some trials and errors and some growing pains, I transitioned into minimally invasive surgery about 13 years or so ago.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I'm excited for our conversation today. And first off, what is the biggest risk that you took in your career that actually paid off?
I think it was, as I mentioned just previously, which was taking a chance on minimally invasive surgery about 13 or 14 years ago. It was a field that was relatively uncharted, unpublished in. A few people were dabbling in it, and I took a hard look at myself and my practice, and I kind of questioned some of the outcomes that I was getting from large open surgeries, and I said to myself at that time that maybe it's worthwhile to look at some alternatives to help improve patient outcomes, and spent some hours and days in the cadaver lab, and then transitioned over, and it's been the best thing for my career.
Fantastic. That, you know, it sounds really interesting in terms of your thought process for evaluating some of the minimally invasive techniques and then deciding to actually move forward with them. When you were going through that process, how did you decide, you know, what would make sense and be beneficial for your patients versus what maybe was, you know, a little bit more of a trend for the day or the hot topic, but something that wasn't sustainable?
Yeah, I think actually it's even more simplistic than that. When I started, no one was really doing it, so it was more trial and error. I made a lot of mistakes, and I published many of our papers on the early learning curve, and I give talks on kind of the ethics of the learning curve and the complication profile of it, and I struggled. I think I tried to try to bounce ideas off of people, and people weren't necessarily forthright about what they were doing minimally invasively or what they were accomplishing. And I just kind of got to a point, there was an inflection point in my career about 5 or 6 years into it, where I had a conversation. I remember this conversation. I had this conversation with my girlfriend, who ended up being my wife now, about, and she's a surgeon also, about, am I doing the right thing here, kind of battling through this learning curve and trying to figure things out and developing these, you know, helping to develop or further these techniques. And she kind of made a poignant comment to me, which was, if at the end of the day you feel like you are going to be a better surgeon advocate for your patients, then absolutely should continue through. And I was fortunate enough to make it through that learning curve, and I felt it was kind of my responsibility to publish and to give comfort to people who are early in their career or adapting new technology on what is a safe way to do it. I don't think that necessarily we do that a good job of that in medicine and as well as in particular in spine surgery.
Got it. That's really interesting to hear. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Now, what do you do differently that has made your career successful?
I think the biggest thing is, you know, and I tell this to our trainees, our residents, or fellows, or people who come to visit us to watch us operate or do different techniques, is that I always tell them I'm always critical in evaluating myself on how to improve and how to get better. And I give the analogy, and I don't know, I'm saying that surgeons are athletes or surgeons are, you know, at that level, but in some ways, you know, it always kind of baffled me that you did all this training, you learned your techniques, and then you went out and practiced. And I saw colleagues, contemporaries say, well, I've been doing this for 20 years and it's been working. And I looked at that and I said, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. You don't see LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Aaron Rodgers, whoever that elite athlete saying, well, I'm here at the top and I'm just going to stay here doing the same thing. They constantly evolve. So I think the biggest change for me, or the biggest kind of change in perspective and paradigm shift, was forcing myself to iterate and to improve. And I tell that to our fellows every year. I say, if you come back and watch me operate a year or two from now, there's something that I should be different. There's something I should have learned or incorporated into my practice that made me better, faster, more efficient, better outcome. And I keep on trying to evolve as a surgeon, as opposed to saying, well, I've made it here now and I'm good for the next 10 to 15 years.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great point. And it's so interesting to think about, you know, from the vantage point of, like you said, professional athletes are always improving and trying to find ways to add to their game. As a surgeon, what do you do in order to continue to grow and develop your practice? Is it just learning about new techniques, or are there other things that you can do to really evolve yourself in your career?
I think it's kind of like there's a Steph Curry quote. He stated, you know, It only took me 26 years, 4 months, 30 days to become an overnight success. And I think the quote is kind of poignant in that, you know, getting better as a surgeon, I don't think it just happens kind of out of thin air. I think, you know, I still spend a lot of time in the cadaver lab, kind of looking at different approaches, different techniques, kind of going back over anatomy. And every time I do a course or I teach a course or chair a course, I always make it my goal to learn one new thing from a surgeon who may be just coming to participate or something else that I can learn and incorporate into my practice. So I think I'm always constantly challenging myself and trying to look for ways to grow.
That's a really great point, and I love that Steph Curry quote. Now, how do you see outpatient spine evolving over the next few years or so?
I mean, that's like the hot question, and I always answer by saying it's already evolved. I mean, if you're not doing outpatient spine surgery right now, you're behind, and if you're doing it now, you're behind in 5 years. And so I think, you know, the evolution of it is only beneficial for the patient and the healthcare system alone. I mean, delivering cost-efficient care, high-quality outcomes for patients, I mean, it's here. And I think what it's done is really changed the playing field. It's allowed surgeons to continue to maintain their autonomy independent from large healthcare systems or hospital acquisitions, allows them to deliver the care to the patients that are demanding a higher level of service, a higher level of return to function. So, you know, how does it evolve? I think that, you know, the market share is still very small, but I think it's continuing to grow. I mean, just it's dominated by so many market pressures that it's inevitable. And I think at the end of the day, what it really does do, no matter how much it changes, it places the surgeon back in command. I mean, they're the gatekeeper to the patient, and I think it allows them to continue in an autonomous fashion where they can continue to deliver high-quality care that they can control. I think that's the most important. I think that oftentimes the challenges we face in healthcare and physicians and clinician extenders is that we may be dictated oftentimes about what we can do or can't do in large healthcare systems. And this kind of avoids that and does in a cost-efficient, highly effective kind of a manner that improves patient outcomes.
Got it. So do you see, you know, outpatient spine and spine in ASC, is that kind of like a golden ticket for surgeons who don't want to be employed to stay independent?
100%. I mean, I think physicians have now realized, spine surgeons in particular, and even my arthroplasty colleagues more so now, they have realized that what an undervalued commodity they were beforehand. They didn't realize the value on the facility side. And I think that allows them to maintain practices that are now being, you know, overburdened by either healthcare administrative guidelines, medical records and EMR, declining reimbursement, which every year over a year, the physician rates are being cut, peer-to-peer reviews, which are utilized just to deny surgical attention to patients that require it. That allows another lifeline to stay independent and autonomous.
Got it. That makes a ton of sense. Now, before we wrap up our conversation here, can you share three trends in healthcare that you're following most closely today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest trend that just kind of relates to spine surgery, the biggest trend I see is the lack of, corporate risk and innovation. Now, people always talk about innovation, but if you really look at what's happened in spine surgery, most of the private equity money, the venture capital money that used to be abound 10 years or so, or even more, is gone. And so, you know, companies have now just kind of become hyper-focused on their commodities, pedicle screws, cages, et cetera. That's not really innovation per se. Their research and development budgets have really shrunk. They are the C-level or the corporate level executives for these companies are risk averse. So if you see it, there's almost no company that has any internal development of new technology. And by new technology, I mean ideas that are not just based upon a 510K, so something that has a predicate before that they'd make a little modification to. IDE trials have completely dried up. Companies are now not willing to spend that dollar up front and take the risk. They're not rewarded on by their shareholders or by their own board. So it's led to a drying up of money. And I think what's happened now is there's been kind of a focus on smaller companies going through the regulatory process, potentially having something potentially innovative, and then companies only acquiring them after they establish a steady state or increasing rate of revenues. And so companies are willing to overpay on a multiple of EBITDA for a small company, but they're not willing to take a chance and develop internally new products. And so I think the biggest trend that I see is that we've become risk averse in new technology and spine. And yeah, there are different things that are coming out, but it's not necessarily so groundbreaking and innovative. And it goes down to that financial modeling. And I really think that the next probably iteration in healthcare and spine in particular is on the diagnostic side. So if you really look at it, like we've kind of improved our techniques and we have augmented realities and we have robots, we can argue about the value, but we really haven't changed how we work up spine patients. MRIs don't tell us how pain is generated. They don't really give us any insight into what the pathology may be. And spine still suffers from a diagnostic dilemma. That means the outcome is really predicated on selecting the right patient. And we haven't improved upon that. So I think you're going to start seeing a lot of diagnostic imaging technologies come down the pipeline, which may better improve our outcomes by improving our natural selection of these patients for surgeries.
Dr. Singh, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. This has been a really fascinating discussion, and I look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Thank you, Laura, for having me.